Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Homebrewers Association. Get back to brew school savings when you join the American Homebrewers Association. Now through August 31st, join the AHA and choose a free brewing book valued at up to $24.95. Choose from Designing Great Beers, the ultimate guide to brewing classic beer styles by Ray Daniels, Brewing Local, American-Grown Beer by Stan Hieronymus, or For the Love of Hops, The Practical Guide to Aroma, Bitterness, and the Culture of Hops, also by Stan Hieronymus. Get offer details at homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing. That's homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 25th, 2022. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Sherwin Santiano, who teaches professional maltsters how to malt at the Canadian Malting Barley Technical Center, is going to teach us how to malt at home. We can take our home brewing to yet another level of customization. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And many thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. This past week, Steve Wilkes and I got together to shoot four video episodes. We survived, and the beverages that we sampled were mighty good. Strangely, weird... The episodes got longer as we progressed through the shooting session. Funny how that happens. We did two beers and essentially three meads. The last episode that we shot was about my simple mead made with local honey and then flavored with tinctures. So technically, that counts for two meads in that last episode. Everything was really good. If I can be self-congratulatory, financial supporters will see early releases starting this week, along with recipes and behind-the-scenes videos of the ones that I made. That was a lot of fun, and we're good for this month and next month, and heck, maybe October. I don't know. Speaking of fun, mark your calendars for Saturday, September 10th. That's when the parking lot of our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity in Tulsa, will be transformed into the annual Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational. I went last year. It was a ton of fun, and as you heard on the show, and it's hard to believe it's been a year since that previous one, craft breweries from all over Oklahoma will be serving some of their standards as well as some rare beers and one-offs brewed specifically for the festival. So check out tcbi.beer for details or look for Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational on Facebook. And I'm hoping that to be there myself wandering around with my microphone again this year. And while you're there in the parking lot, you can check out Pippin's Tap Room and the big and beautiful High Gravity Homebrew Shop, home of the Warthog Electric Brewing Systems, and you can meet Desiree and Dave yourself in person. They can help you take the pain out of propane, just like for me. And if you go to highgravitybrew.com and use the code EBC75BB, you can save $75 off your Warthog Electric Brewing purchase. Remember, Saturday, September 10th, for the Tulsa Craft Beer Invitational in the parking lot of family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. Okay, we talked about home malting a while back, but it has been a while. It's been a few years. Sherwin Santiano runs workshops at the Canadian Malting Barley Technical Center that train professional maltsters and others interested in the malting process. And he also gives the people that he trains tips on malting at home, because watching the process on the smallest scale can help us learn about what's going on in the bigger process. Sherwin Santiano, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Nice to be here, James.
Now, you're at the Canadian Malting Barley Technical Center, or the CMBTC. First of all, where are you? What do you do with them? And how did you get into all this?
We are located in beautiful Winnipeg, Manitoba, here in Canada. Actually, the way I had gone into the company was I was a co-op student at some point in time about 7 or 8 years ago. And upon graduating, I just stumbled upon an open position. And here I am 6 or 7 years later.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, you're in the technical side of things.
Yes. So with my position, I look over, obviously, malt. I'm the malting technician here, along with my colleague, Mr. Aaron Onio. And we look over our pilot and micro malting systems.
And you, I looked at your website, cmbtc.com, and you provide a lot of training in small groups to train people how to be professional maltsters.
Yeah, so here at the CMBTC, we have one of the few malting courses globally. And at our course, it's actually called the Malt Academy. You can find us on Instagram as well under Malt Academy. So essentially we teach and train people who are just interested in malt. It could be somebody who is starting a craft malt house. And sometimes it's honestly just people who work at malt companies and need some training, whether they be new employees or seasoned employees. We get a whole slew of people. And even from breweries, we get a lot of people. We get everyone under the sun, really, if I think about it. So, if you're interested in malt and you want to know more, we host this course about a couple times a year.
Now, you emailed me saying that, one of the things that you could talk to us about, that you could teach us about, is home malting. Yes. And I'm assuming that opens you up to, you're back to square one as far as, if you do your own home malting, the unpredictability of the malting process comes back from the olden days.
Well, you can. So, you're bringing it all back. This is a couple things with home malting. Why I think it is a very cool thing to add to your brewing process. It's that level of control. It's being able to introduce another product within your product, essentially. And it's playing with that I think generates different permutations of different avenues that someone can explore. And I think it's a beautiful thing. But in terms of how you're going to do that and replicate it, at the end of the day, let's take malting in its simplest form. Okay. You are essentially being a farmer. You're growing the barley under controlled conditions. How you get there. So this is a bit of an economics thing. When you are smaller, you can handle more, I would say, change without having to worry about economic costs, right? Because these are not going to influence farther down into your bottom line. And at the end of the day, as a home brewer, you can buy the expensive hops, right? This is affordable, quote unquote, because you are buying at a small scale,
right?
And whereas somebody who's even a craft brewery, maybe they can't buy the cool, super expensive hops because they need to care a little bit about their costs. So with home malting, although it is technical, it is a whole nother addition to figuring out your brewing process because it's another thing. You can get by without having to worry as much, because you're not trying to meet a particular spec that could come further down the line when you're home malting. But what you're trying to do is just make a functional malt and then replicate that recipe. The beautiful thing about barley and malt is that When I process a sample and I keep everything the same, if I replicate that a second time, it comes out kind of identical. It's really cool. And this kind of comes from just, like at the CMDC, we have a micro malting facility and pile malt facility, but when I repeat a trial or I use the same control sample, yeah, the malt barley, if you have that specific control, the barley will take up water the same. It will process similarly. So it's really nice to be able to just change a couple things where I feel like in the brewing process, it's harder to have that control because you're dealing obviously even with the yeast, and the yeast is a lot more finicky than I would say the barley, to be honest. And that's because you're dealing with a microbe. And when you deal with microbes and you're dealing with small things like that, time is very quick on their end. Right. If you think a dog, it's kind of like dog ears or similar to that. I mean, microbes are just, they're just, they see a million lifetimes before we see one lifetime. Right. So, when they want to move a certain way, they will act as a group. And when they act as a group, when they grow up to a certain size, they can really influence a lot of things very quickly. So now with home malting, at the end of the day, let's bring it back a little again. You're growing barley out. You are essentially being a farmer who doesn't have to rely on Mother Nature. You are a farmer who can work on your own time, and give it the proper water and control the temperature. Really, it's just water and temperature and air. And if you can, so I'll bring in even a little thing to here too. For those who are unaware where to look, there is a really wonderful Facebook group called Home and Professional Maltsters. Yeah, and it's a really cool group. I suggest a lot of people look into it. It's relatively active, and it's great because you have a lot of home maltsters and even professional maltsters who have joined the group. So there's a good slew of information there, and people are just fabricating their own little systems. It's great. People are doing small scale. Some people will do a drum. Some people are just repurposing fridges. And it's really cool. And also too, if another resource, there's a gentleman over in BC, his name is Francois, and he has a Brewing Beer the Hard Way website and blog and YouTube videos, et cetera. And he's also part of that group, and his stuff is really great because he's doing everything, as his name suggests, the hard way, and he's making his own malt. He's formulating his own recipe. So he's a great resource to figure out how to home malt. But for my case, I like to keep things nice and simple. This is something that we actually showcase to people on our course is home malting. And the reason why we introduce it to people is a lot of the participants who come on our course, I mean, some of them are maltsters, some of them are people who work in a lab, some people are grain companies, some people are over on the breeding side of things. So a lot of times, even they're just brewers who are just curious about malt and how it actually works. But a decent majority are actually people who are looking to become a craft maltster. And coming on our course, it's a bit of a chicken and the egg scenario because you want to learn about malt, but you also want to fabricate a new system. Right. So if you've ever known a maltster, and this is, I think, true across globally, part of knowing what to do is because you have people there who know the system in and out. They've basically ironed out what's finicky about their system, what are the downsides, what are the upsides, and how they're able to make that product consistently for the past 100 years. Unfortunately, with a craft maltster, they're not going to have that because they're going to go in a little bit blind. So we introduced a home malting for essentially for craft maltsters to figure out to get a taste of how to malt without having to make the mistakes on their bigger systems.
Right. And if they know what the process looks like on the small scale, then they'll recognize it. It's similar to brewing, I'd assume. You know, if you make a few batches of homebrew, when you walk into a brewery, it's like, oh, okay, I understand the process.
Yes. Yeah, that's essentially it, because similar to brewing, you're, at least on the malt side of things, you're trying to figure out, how does this grow? What am I looking for? I mean, you just see growing barley. It takes a while to get that practice or that feel, right? And then you look at your malt analysis numbers, and then you start to adjust. So the whole malt is an easy way for you to just figure out your systems and what works. And oddly enough, even if you have the identical recipe and you scale it up to a different system or you go to a different system, sometimes it's completely different. Right. Mm. So it's the whole malt is more just to figure out what you're looking for, so that you know when you go on a different system, you still know what you're looking for, essentially.
I talked to the guys at Sugar Creek Malting Company, and I asked them about home malting, and they issued a word of caution, saying that at a certain point in the process, if things go wrong, you can actually create something that makes you sick. Is that something that we need to worry about?
Yes. So a caveat to home malting that I want to put out there is similar to a maltster, and if you're going to take up home malting, you also need to take those considerations. You're going to care about your barley selection. So if you are going to home malt, you want to ensure that you have selectable malt barley grade. And what James is mentioning here is he's referring to something called vomitoxin. It's just a toxin produced by a species of microbe called Fusarium. And they're going to produce this toxin. So if you ever see pink kernels, you want to stay away from that. And you want to stay away from barley that has been exposed to high amount of moisture, especially during harvest.
Hmm.
Okay. Obviously, water is good for barley in the growing season, but it's at that point of harvest that if it gets rained on, et cetera, it can actually proliferate the Fusarium species on there. So as long as it looks super yellow, if it looks super yellow, you know that it probably didn't get rained on. You can just tell. You'll always know pre-sprouted. So another thing too, is you don't want pre-sprouted barley as well, because it's going to mold kind of weird. And it also might start losing germination over time.
That makes sense.
So stay away from stained barley, but try to somehow find, I don't know how you're going to do it. I didn't think that far enough. If you have a farmer who's sold malt grade barley that was selected for, and you look at it and it's completely yellow, looks like a golden sunshine, then honestly, I think you'd be pretty good to go. And like I said, this is obviously a concern for brewers and maltsters. So they're always watching for this. But don't look pink.
I malted a very small, like half a pound of barley, just for the heck of it, several years ago. And I got it from a seed company. It's probably not practical to get a whole bunch from a seed. It's probably going to be a lot more expensive than other sources. But I'm assuming that, if you're going to want to use barley for seed, that they would take care of it in such a way that it would not, encounter these kinds of problems.
Yeah, in a general sense, so for seed production, what they really care about there is whether the barley, I guess what they really care, they care about the germination of it. They don't, I guess in a very technical sense, they do not actually care if it has Fusarium levels on it. But it tends to be what they care about a lot too is purity, because they want the variety to be very specific.
Mm.
So when a farmer is growing out that malt barley, it is that's what they always ensure is varietal purity, varietal purity and germination. So it tends to be very good in clean seed. So they go through different levels. Be uns If you're unsure, it's like food. If you're unsure, just throw it out. Yeah. If it looks really good, I mean, you'll know what I'm talking about when you see really good barley. Is it doesn't feel like there's any black on it at all, and you should be pretty good. So look for the staining. There's no staining, and it looks pretty gold. But look at where your sources are coming from. And like I said, I haven't really thought about how you guys are gonna source it. Maybe you ask the homebrew shop. Yeah. Can you carry barley? No, but no, I'm just joking. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know what you sell it for, but yeah, it would be an option.
This past weekend, I ate some 30-year-old wedding cake. You know how you're supposed to save some of your cake for a year in the freezer and bring it out on your first anniversary for good luck? Well, we kept forgetting. For 29 years, we forgot. Until this year, a 30th anniversary. I dug it out of the freezer, literally, and thawed it out, and I took a taste. The cake itself was pretty dry, and the icing was crunchy, but it actually tasted pretty good. And it didn't die. But the reason I bring this up is because I made a cream ale to celebrate the occasion with A44 Kvaking from our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast in celebration of that big day. I fermented at basement temperature, 72 degrees Fahrenheit, around 22 degrees Celsius, which is a departure. I usually, brew outside in the hot summertime heat or, ferment it outside with Kvike. But the Kviking kicked off more slowly than if I had pitched in the summer heat. But it was bubbling before bedtime, and it was pretty much done fermenting in about 4 days. And Steve and I sampled that beer for the video, the video that you'll see later this week, if you are a Patreon member. But we sampled that 8 days after brewing. Super clean and delicious. Just a week after brewing. I love Kvike. I love Kviking. Now Imperial has a new hybrid yeast that's a cross between Juice, an English strain, and Loki, a Kvike strain. And that hybrid is I-22 Capri. It's not a blend. It's an actual genetic hybrid. I made a hoppy beer with Capri that was delicious. And Steve made a mead, which fermented very well and was also very tasty. So Capri is very versatile. Not a surprise coming from Imperial Organic Yeast. I like to say my stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore to make starters for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. Ask your local homebrew store about I-22 Capri, A44 Kvaking from Imperial Organic Yeast, and check them out at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. So what kind of equipment are we going to need if we're going to malt our own grain at home?
Yeah, so these are a set of instructions that I've kind of given out to homebrewers before too. I mean, so for the malting process, there's about three steps. Just for those who are unaware, first step is called steeping. As the name suggests, you're just giving it water. Okay, but you're not just giving it water. It almost feels like you're drowning the barley. Okay, you're steeping it, as the name suggests. And then you're going to be draining the barley after a given amount of time, and then you're going to steep it again. And all you're trying to do is bring the moisture percentage. At the end of the steeping, when you achieve the moisture percentage you want, the next step is called germination. And with germination, you are effectively controlling the growth of it using temperature, air, and water to make sure that it doesn't lose that moisture that you just gave it. You just want to keep it around there, and you effectively want to grow it to a specific stage of that life cycle. What I would suggest to homebrewers, because obviously you guys don't have the experience, nor are you going to have the technical capabilities to actually analyze your malt, I give a general guideline that what you're going to be looking for is something called the acrospire on a barley kernel. And this thing will essentially become the basically the stem or the shoot, and it will form the plant. So on the backside of the barley kernel, if you ever open it up, you want that shoot to technically be 3/4 to the full length of the barley kernel. But to make it easier for you guys, as long as it's protruding out just slightly, slightly outside of the kernel, that you don't have to cut it open or anything, that's fine. That means that you probably modified it well. Is it too much? Potentially. Maybe the barley plants start eating some of those sugars. But that's okay. At a homebrew stage, that's fine.
Now, is that stage called chitting? Chitting?
Oh, yeah. So, got to clarify that. Yeah. There's a lot of jokes I hear all the time.
Yeah, so, I've seen a t-shirt or two.
Yeah. The chit is actually it's more or less, it's the coleorrhiza. It's going to be the rootlets. It's the sheath that's going to form. So chitting, when people talk about chitting, they're actually talking about the opposite side.
The other side. Okay.
When you look at a barley kernel, the chit is the little white thing that's going to poke out. That means the barley is germinating. So you're like, okay, great. It's chitting. The acrospire is kind of like a ruler that you're always trying to see, well, where is it at now? Where is it at now? And that's what the acrospire kind of represents, at least mentally in my head, is where is the kernel in its life cycle? So ideally you want 3/4 to a full length. And the reason why they want that is because they know there's enough enzymes that the barley's plant has produced, but they know that they haven't eaten too much of that sugar. Once you grow farther than the full length of the kernel, you will start noticing that the acrospire will start turning green. And that's okay if it's a little bit green, but you don't want it to be green, because obviously now the plant is able to make its own energy. And when it makes its own energy, it probably means it's starting to eat a lot of its starch reserves that you want. But yeah, that's essentially germination. As a safe bet, grow that acrospire a little bit longer and then the full length of the kernel, and you should be fine.
And the roots will come right out. I mean, it'll look like little, you know, little octopuses or something. You know, the roots will come out of the seed. And you know, it kind of might throw you off if you've never seen the process before, because you've never seen roots in you know, in the grain bin at the homebrew store. You know, because they knock all those off. But yeah, that's part of the process too.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess people generally don't just throw in a bunch of seeds with water and let them grow, right? So it's
except in fifth grade science class. Then
Well, you know, you're normally used to if you're trying to grow a seed, you throw it into the soil, and then the roots start to grow into the soil,
right?
So it's weird to just see that you threw. It would be like going to the home hardware store and grabbing a bunch of tomato seeds or something, and just growing them all in one vat. So, and that's what we're doing. It's just, so, you know, it's a, yeah. So that's the germination step. You're going to want to grow it to that specific stage. And then you tell the barley plant, okay, I want to be finished. And you're going to do something called the kilning step. And the kilning step, kind of what the name suggests, is there's some form of heat, it's doing something, but really what you're trying to do is just dehydrate the barley. Okay, you want to remove the moisture. You're going to do that with air. You're just essentially blowing a fan through the barley, but you're also going to want to have increased temperatures. So these increased temperatures just allow for the water to evaporate quicker, essentially. So that's the kiln step. Dehydrate the barley and so that you make sure that the enzymes do not get degraded, and turn it into a functional product that the brewer can then use.
And I think I actually used my batch was so small that I actually used a food dehydrator to do that.
Yeah, use a food dehydrator. It works perfectly fine. That's actually what we use when we do our home malt setup. Going back, sorry, I always go all over the place. That's the malt process. To do the malt process, obviously a malt company has pneumatic systems and they got a whole bunch of other different things and they're doing it at large scale. We're going to scale it back as a homebrew and as a home malt. So I'm going to start calling you guys home maltsters now. We're going to scale it back. And when we scale it back, we don't need a whole lot of equipment. What you really need for the steep step really is a pail, a container that you can throw water and a bunch of barley kernels. Okay. I even have, if you work a 9-to-5, because as I mentioned previously, during the steep cycle, sort of steep step, you are going to fill it with water and then you're going to drain it. You're going to fill it with water, you're going to drain it. Well, you're going to ask Sherwin, how am I going to do that? I got work. I don't want to be looking at this thing all the time. Well, here is a step-by-step steep recipe that would work if you work a 9-to-5. And if you don't work a 9-to-5, well,
pretend.
Just extrapolate to a different time. I don't know. I don't know what time you guys sleep. So, so for example, my recipe is very simple. It's just a 10-hour wet, 12-hour dry, 12-hour wet, 12-hour dry, and then 12-hour wet. So it's just 10 for a wet and then just a bunch of 12s.
Huh.
Now, what time do you want to start that? So fortunately, being in where I'm at, I'm always thinking about time that I start something and what I'm running my system. So this comes easier to me. But for you guys, at 10 o'clock, you can start it for 10 hours during the wet. And that will take you to essentially 8 o'clock, 8 a.m. right in the morning. So right before you're heading out and you are saying bye to your family, you say, wait, I need to drain my barley. Right. So yeah. So you're going to be draining it. And then from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., it will be essentially in a dry cycle, just hanging out. If anyone's at home, maybe they can mix it a little bit, but you're just essentially going to be letting that barley sit. If anything, you don't want it to be too compacted, meaning, the barley might start heating up. So if you could somehow disperse it into a different bin or a bin with more surface area, that would be very useful. And you're just going to dry it, essentially. Now, a maltster would want to do, they want to remove the CO2 and they want to control the temperature. But for you guys just leave it out in this, in, you know, out at home. Then you come home from work and 8 p.m. you start another 12-hour cycle. And if you continue this process, it's just going to go 8 p.m., 8 a.m., 8 p.m. And at the end of this three wet cycle, it will take you to 8 a.m. Two days later, essentially.
Yeah.
At the end of this steep cycle, because effectively what you're just trying to do is get the barley to the right moisture. And obviously it's going to be impacted or at least influenced by the initial barley moisture, but let's say it's around 10-12%. It should get it close to there using this recipe. You should be hovering. And there's ways of determining moisture content at home. It might be a little bit tricky. I don't want to explain it over here because it involves math.
But essentially, I think if I can remember what I did, I weighed the dry seeds.
Yes.
And then weighed them after they'd been, you know, I'd been through the soaking cycle.
Oh, okay.
And then figured out how much essentially water they'd, I don't know. I watched a YouTube video somewhere. So
what James is mentioning here is sorry, I'm saying James like I'm talking to somebody else. And I'm just talking to you.
Well, you can talk to the audience.
Yeah.
you can violate the fourth wall. That's no problem.
Yeah. What you're mentioning. So yeah, that definitely works. So when you're taking up when the weight starts increasing, you know that increase in weight is probably because it's picking up moisture. So mm-hmm. you can just wait afterwards, and that does work. The one caveat to that is that you're going to need to know the initial starting moisture.
Oh.
Because if you don't take into account, you'll never know what the actual moisture is. Does that make sense?
Because the grain is probably, the seed is probably not 100% dry. If it's 100% dry, no, it might not be viable.
No, if it was 100% dry, yeah, that's impossible. You couldn't even do that even if you wanted to.
We've got our soaked grain.
Yeah.
And we've gone through our 8-hour and then 12-hour cycles.
Yes.
And now what?
Yeah, so now you say to yourself, I'm in the proper moisture content. I did my math. I know everything. Now I am basically well, I don't want to use the word incubate because I feel like that means hot. I am now watching my barley plant grow, but I have my eyes on it to make sure. So now you just want to maintain that moisture. You don't want to lose that moisture, but you're just saying to yourself, I want that barley plant to grow to this stage in its life cycle. So you're going to spend 4 to 5 days. This is going to be dependent on the temperature that you're keeping the barley at. It's going to depend on the moisture, whether you're losing too much or you're not spraying it enough. And it's going to care about your airflow as well too. If you're pushing a lot of air, you might start drying it out. So those three things will influence where that plant gets to. But it doesn't matter if I'm over here. It doesn't matter if I'm in cold Winnipeg or you're out in Vietnam or somewhere hot. You can still technically get to the same place. How you get there will be dependent on every monster. So as I mentioned, you want that acrospire to be a little bit past the length of the kernel. If you are there, then you can be pretty sure. And what you're going to want to do is you're going to grab a representative sample of your barley kernels, and you're going to want to examine if that acrospire, so that's that shoot, how much percentage of those acrospires are greater than that length of the kernel, right? You want to count 100 kernels if you can and see, are there any kernels that are super, if you peel it back, the acrospire is maybe even half of a length, then you know that maybe you're not providing enough airflow, or maybe there's a dead spot in the kernels. So the big word that we use here in the monster world, because we're dealing with all these kernels, is something called homogeneity.
Mm-hmm.
And we want everything to just, I want to give it the same treatment to every single kernels. And you guys do that in the same thing in the beer world, but you guys are dealing with a liquid, right? So the liquid is able to act as a singular body.
Right.
When you deal with the barley kernels, you want them to act like a singular body, but they're not, because all you take is one pocket of grain to not get the right airflow, or it's grown too much rootlets. So you want to mix it. It's a lot more finicky in that regard. It's not taken away from brewing. I'm just saying there's a slight kind of difference there.
Yeah. Is there a benefit to mixing around the kernels as they're sprouting, or do you want to leave them alone?
Yeah. So you do want to mix it. And the reason why is, so in a maltster world, the reason why they mix it is because you're going to get a stratification, meaning the air, depending where the airflow is coming from. So you're growing this barley out and you're blowing air from the bottom. Okay. Now that airflow also has humidification. It has water droplets on it that you're spraying onto the air. Now, since it's the first point of contact from the bottom tends to get more of that moisture.
Mm-hmm.
So you do want to mix it. And the way a maltster will mix it is they'll have these screw conveyors that they'll bring. It's almost like a helix. And these screw turners will bring the barley from the bottom to the top and then throw it on top, right? And this will essentially mix the top and the bottom. So you want to mix that. But also why you want to mix it is so that barley kernels at the bottoms don't start forming too long of rootlets. And the reason why is because it will start to mat up and form kind of like a little carpet. And when it mats up, you restrict airflow. And then you start generating heat because the heat has nowhere to go because there's no airflow. And that's just because if you ever deal with if you start growing a malt barley, you'll notice that the rootlets are going to travel and they're going to extend to the moisture in the air because it wants to get that moisture. So if the moisture in the air is coming from the bottom, they're going to start traveling lower and lower. So you do want to mix it. And, even if you see something like a drum system, they don't even grow a lot of rootlets because you're constantly mixing. So the air is coming from it's attacking every kernel evenly that the rootlets never have to grow that long. So anyways, it's a bit of a side note. But yeah, you're going to want to mix it and you're going to want to spray with some level of water. And if you can, if you are an engineer or you're somebody who has a lot of time that you want to start designing your own system, you can implement some level of airflow, right? And some people will repurpose some motors to just blow air or something. So,
I
yeah.
don't remember. I know, there are some systems that you can use like a box fan, and build shelves with, like a screening in them, and have the air come up from underneath. I don't think I got that elaborate, on my little batch. I think I just may I think I mainly just like mixed it around a lot and spritzed every now and then. It wasn't
Yeah,
very.
no, it's perfectly fine. Like the reason why you need the airflow, at least in a mod, like in a pneumatic malt system, is because I mean you're dealing with such high levels of grain that if you did not dissipate that heat, it would just like the bottom would never would just be super hot, and then that will and you are also using the air to there's that control, right? You want to keep the temperature the same. And also the moisture. Yeah, you need a way to implement the moisture. And some malt houses have it where too under screw turners they have a water injection system that will, as it's mixing, it will like spray it on there. But to make sure it doesn't lose too much moisture, you want your air to always have moisture on it. Otherwise, you're just dehydrating. You're essentially gonna turn yourself into a kiln without heat, essentially. So in our cases, I mean, this is where having a thin layer helps. Yeah, then making sure you keep up the moisture, spraying it every now and then. Don't spray too much. You just want to have it mixed very nicely. And as long as you're doing that, I mean, you should be fine. And if you can keep it cool, and the reason why you want to keep it relatively cool, maybe your basement, somewhere cool, is because you want to remove microbial growth, or you want to reduce it. So having these lower temperatures really make sure the barley grows, whereas the microbes don't grow as much. So, but if you got pretty clean, good clean barley, yeah. So it's not the biggest case, but the thing to watch out for that I think even I run into when I'm doing a whole malt setup is having too much water. And even feel free at the very beginning. One thing I forgot to mention during the steep is to rinse that barley like crazy, right? A big malt house isn't going to do that because obviously it's a whole lot of water and a whole lot of money. But there are things that they do, but like overflowing it a little bit. But for a malt, for a home malt or a home brewer, I mean, just rinse it. Just keep until it starts running kind of clear, and that'll really help, actually. You remove a lot of that load off of that microbial load off of it, and you remove a lot of the small material will also collect into water. But yeah, so that's kind of germination. You're just growing it, examining it, making sure the rootlets don't get too crazy, and making sure that that aquaspire is coming out and just tracking it. What you can do is you can actually analyze every day and seeing, okay, how much more do the aquaspires grow? So what maltsters will do is they will actually take a representative sample, and every day they will do their counts and see what percentage of their kernels are getting past a certain point. So is it grown to a half length of the kernel to three quarter of the length? Is it in the three quarter to a full length? So you grab about 100 kernels and you see where your distribution lies. And you will see, it's what's really cool is you will actually see the distribution increasing and moving up the different parts of the barley kernel. So yeah, that's they call it growth counts, acrospire counts, but it's not chit counts. Chit counts you could run like when you finish steeping and you want to see if your kernel's actually germinated. So that's another thing too, is during steep, if you did everything right and you didn't drown a barley, you should have a lot of chits there. The acrospires haven't grown because it's just the end of steep, but you will notice that you're looking for that white, they call it the coleoriza, and it's going to protect the rootlets, and it's going to just turn into eventually the rootlets.
Every week, it seems there's more good news coming from our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies in Vermont. This week, Ricky says the fall seasonal Wild Hunt is available for pre-sale. Wild Hunt is a spiced blood orange and cranberry mead that's brewed in honor of the ceremonial meads of 18th century Northern Europe. At 6.2%, it's practically sessionable for a mead, a ruby red grapefruit color with an aroma of cinnamon, cloves, and allspice, and the flavor of bright citrus, cranberry, cinnamon, and cloves on the finish. Kind of like a blood orange mimosa. Wild Hunt is a celebration of fall, which is my favorite time of year. Whether you like big meads like the ones in the Ancient Collection, very sessionable honey drinks like the Honey Spritzers, or deliciously drinkable craft meads like Wild Hunt, you can have honey-based deliciousness sent to you in most states across the country from Groenfell.com. Free shipping for orders over $75 at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. So at the end of germination, and you know, after your barley is, your malt now is fully fully modified, then you go to the food dehydrator and and dry it out. Or I guess theoretically, and we may not even want to cover this at this point, if you wanted to get super fancy, you could put your green, your wet malt into your oven and make crystal malt. You could actually convert those, use the moisture and the enzymes in the wet malt to convert those starches in the kernel into sugar, you know, using your oven and make a, make your own crystal malt.
Well, yeah. So what you can do, so it's a combination of things. Obviously, the thing with the dehydrator, you're not able to reach higher temps, and you're effectively using a dehydrator like a fan, because that's what a dehydrator is, really, right?
Right, right.
You have a fan there with air, and you're dissipating any of that moisture so that it leaves the kernel. So to add more technicalness about kilning, there are three steps to kilning. There's something called the free drying stage, withering stage, whatever you want to call it. And this is just that the barley kernel will lose moisture as long as you give it air. If you're just blowing air, the moisture will just evaporate just willy-nilly, okay? That's a free dry stage. Now, when, in order to get more of that moisture out, you're actually going to need to increase the temperatures, and this will effectively carry that moisture. It'll actually force dry, they call force drying, and it's just going to move the moisture from the inside of the kernel out, and that's force drying. When the relative humidity of the kiln drops, you know that you've evacuated a lot of that moisture, quite a bit of it. You might be at like 6-7%, 5% moisture. When you know that no more of that moisture is coming out, even if you increase temperatures, you know that you can then start curing the malt. So the next step is called curing, and that's where you say to yourself, I'm not going to kill any enzymes if I'm trying to make a pale malt or a base malt. I can increase temperatures and start imparting that color and flavor. So that's effectively how a base malt gets made. If you want to start doing these specialty malts or different kind of malts, and you know, you're talking about crystals, etc., the main differentiating factor is, prior to what I was mentioning about you want to evacuate that moisture, here you actually want to keep the moisture. So if you can Even with a dehydrator, if you can somehow keep the moisture in there, either recirculate it back somehow, or you spray it with water, this will make sure that at those temperatures, whether it be 50 degrees Celsius, I don't know Fahrenheit, I'll be honest, what would that be?
50 be is around 120 something, yeah.
120? Okay. Yeah. At those temperatures, you will be entering sugar conversion,
mm-hmm.
right? And the longer that you keep at that temperature, the more of those Maillard reactions you will get when you increase the temperature. And for those who are unfamiliar with the Maillard reaction, that's just that it's not technically browning, but it is the brown color and sweet flavor that you get when you have a lot of sugars and amino acid or nitrogen compounds. Those form the Maillard reaction, and you add heat and water. You'll get more of those Maillard flavors. But also, too, if you produce a lot of those small sugars, because the water, essentially what you're creating is a small mash. If you can keep that moisture in, you are creating a lot of small reducing sugars, is what they call it. And these reducing sugars can then crystallize when you increase the temperature. And then you get that glassiness.
Right.
So when you were saying to throw it right in the oven, the caveat to that would be that you need to keep that moisture in there. How you do it, we've done it with a kiln where we've done some levels. Like me and my colleague, we did something in a kiln. So it was using that blower and that air. But the thing is, we have a recirculation option in our pilot system. So we can recirculate the water back in so that it never gets removed off of the kiln.
I guess theoretically you could use a pan of water in the bottom of the oven. That's a bread making trick, I think. But also don't open the door so much. when your glasses steam up when you open the oven, that's that's moisture leaving.
No, totally. You can keep pan of the water. I guess the thing is too is you want to somehow get that water to go onto the grain.
I actually took some tuberose, some malted barley, or it was Maris Otter. Some Maris
Otter. You just
spread
water, right?
And soaked it in water, and then put that in the oven. And sort of made my own, kind of crystal malt, and it worked. It seemed to, at least. In theory, it's the same kind of along the same lines.
You know what? That would be a better option. What I suggest is instead of recirculating it or forming, I think if you had that green malt, what you could do is actually have hot, well, not super hot, but like 60 degree water. Like, did you put it in kind of hot water when you did that with the Maris Otter?
I think so. I can't remember. I'll have to go back and look at the video.
Okay. I'll watch it.
60 is 140. Fair enough.
Oh, okay. 140.
We're usually going in the other direction on the,
on the temperature. I know. I remember at some point in your pod. One thing too, James, I forgot to even mention this. I remember when I first got this job, for me to learn about brewing, actually, I listened to your podcast starting from like, whenever you started, was it 2005?
Five?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I remember, that's how I actually learned about brewing, was listening, because I'm like, well, I can't listen to the technical talks because I'm just going to be nodding my head in agreeance without ever knowing what they're talking about. So
I'll listen to these idiots from Arkansas.
No, well, you know what, James? Honestly, you got a great like radio voice, so it really made it easy for me to just put it on and just kind of, I would start learning a bit more. And I remember even, I think people were talking about, I remember having a reader ask if you could convert it into Celsius.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah. And then I remember even, even talking about Hurricane Katrina. So yeah, I really went right from the beginning.
Wow.
I listened to quite a bit of it. So
well, yeah, excellent.
I haven't been a fan from the beginning, but I'm a fan who, listened from the beginning. That's where I started. Okay.
We get a lot of those.
Yeah.
I think, is there anything, I mean, it sounds like we've taken the process from beginning to end. I tried to make my own tortillas recently, and you know, they came out okay, but and it's not that complicated to process. It's just a lot of work. and to be good at it, I would have to do it a bunch more. So I think I'm just still going to buy tortillas. But one thing that, you know, doing the malting process, that little thing that I did, it really gave me an appreciation of the process and an appreciation of those who do the process. And if nothing else, it's a good educational opportunity, even if you're not going to, you know, switch over and malt all your own grain for the rest of your life. It does give you an appreciation of where your food product comes from. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's, you know, this is going to make me sound like almost like a teacher who just, you know, if I get like 1 out of 1,000 people to do it, then I think I succeeded. Okay. So I do agree with you that at the end of the day, why not just buy it? I mean, it's sometimes people say, you know, I'll buy the frozen pierogies. I mean, it's the same, right? I do agree with that sentiment. You know, I'm not saying I make everything homemade scratch. So it's, I know what you're getting at. But I think kind of, as you mentioned, I think homebrewers or brewers in general, we've looked at so many of our ingredients, people get excited over it. And I don't think malt gets its deserved love at times. Mm-hmm. At times, not saying it's always, but at times I think it has a bigger part to play than some people even imagine. And I think whenever I speak to homebrewers, they really are so far removed. They know their yeast. They know a newer yeast. They know what are the yeast trends. They know hop trends. They know different hops. But no one talks about malt in the same way. And it is its own little, you know, we work in our own little vacuum at times, I think, as people. And I think malt is one of those things that why care about it. And I think there's a reason to care for it, and there's a reason to actually think about why it's cool, because I think it's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, if anybody's your target audience, it's this. I mean, you know, we could go out and buy all our own beer too.
Yeah. And that's the same thing. Yeah. It's exactly it. It's just saying, well, why homebrew would be the argument.
Yeah.
Going back on what you're saying with the tortillas, right? Like, well, why homebrew? You could just buy a beer and save yourself 8 hours in a day, right? But we do it for the love of the sport.
Sure.
So I'm trying to say, hey, you know, why not do a little bit more for the love of the sport?
Sure.
And home malt. And yeah, somebody can take me up on it, shoot me an email, send me pictures, join the Facebook group.
Yeah.
Feel free to follow us on Instagram. But yeah, and we talk all about everything. Just shoot us a note if anyone's ever interested. I don't care if you're bothering me. I don't care. you won't bother me is what I'm saying.
Well, excellent. And if you can't find how to get in touch with Sherwin, send me an email and I'll forward it on.
Awesome.
Well, this has been a lot of fun.
Oh yes.
We have visited this topic, you know, a time or two in the past 17 years, but it's good to get back into it and to hear a different, you know, a different perspective on it. And I hope that we can keep in touch and you know, hopefully maybe if people have enough questions, you know, maybe it's worth another look.
Yeah. Do a little malt talk. Malt talk segment.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks, Sherwin.
Oh, thanks, James. Yeah, it's been an honor.
Thanks again to Sherwin. Great conversation and tips. And if you haven't tried home malting, it's fun, especially if you're a science nerd like me. always great to know where your food comes from and how it's made. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.